Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Before we commence this episode of Edgy Ideas podcast, I'd like to share two things. One, our Soul at Work event is a live event. It's taking place in northern Spain, close to Barcelona, in a convent, a spiritual center, where we will be joined by a group of international seekers, people who are trying to find a way to bring their soul to work and to think about what it means to bring your soul at work. We have a lovely group. If you can join us, please do contact me for details. Also, we have a diploma in coaching. Our coaching approach thinks about how to create a good society and how to live a good life. So if you're interested in this way of coaching beyond just individual performance, please get in touch and we'll be launching this online program mid-September. On to the podcast. Welcome everybody to this edition of Edgy Ideas podcast. Today I have two special guests. The first is Daniel B. Frank. Daniel is a graduate of the Francis W. Parker School in Chicago, and he's been their principal for 20 years and a senior administrator there since 1988. He's a founding executive editor of the International Journal of Schools Studies in Education, published by the University of Chicago Press, and he served as executive director of ISPSO, the International Society for the Psychoanalytic Study of Organizations. Daniel, welcome to Edge Ideas.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here with you.
Caro Bainbridge has been a previous guest, and she works at the intersection of psychoanalysis, culture, and organizational life. Caro is an organizational consultant, executive coach, and leadership developer. She's an emeritus professor of psychoanalysis and culture and former editor of Free Associations. She's also co-editor of Routledge's Psychoanalysis and Popular Culture book series, and Caro is a fellow of the RSA and a founding scholar of the British Psychoanalytic Council, and she's recently launched a new Substack called Culture Fix. Her work is animated by the generative potential of thresholds and transitions, a perspective shaped in part by her daily walks on the beach near Anthony Gormley's Another Place, where art, nature, and thought meet the water's edge. You're both very welcome to Edgy Ideas, and we thought we'd talk about place, because Dan, you've been in one place for quite a while, and Caro, you're from Liverpool, and that has a very strong sense of place. So Dan, do you want to say something about your sense of place and your experience of working in the school and being at the school as a pupil and a student? Do you want to say something about that to start us off?
Yeah, I feel fortunate in my life. I've been able to be closely associated with this school, this institution, since I was 6 years old, when I was a skinny little first grader, and I started here. And I went here through my schooling, through high school. And after college, I became an alumni representative to a group, an educational council of people who've gone through the school and want to think about educational philosophy. And then I went off to become a clinical psychologist and social researcher, but I found I missed schools more than hospitals and clinics. So there was an opportunity to return here as a senior administrator. And so there is a very deep sense of place, and that gives a grounding, a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, the ability to connect with people, to develop an ethos, a vision of what a child's life can be at the school, and as well as for the adults. And at the very same time, there are challenges to being in one place, the tendency to become sort of self-centric or place-centric, and how, while one is grounded and has deep roots, how do you keep track of making sure that the branches of the tree, so to speak, can reach out far and wide and be expansive and not siloed and too insular.
Yeah. Caro, do you want to say something about your sense of place? We'll come back, Dan. There's so much to unwrap there. We'll come
Definitely.
Back.
Definitely is. It's fascinating. I'm curious as to how many years you're away as well, Dan. Got this idea of you kind of going on a little kind of trip around the world and then returning home. And it's, for me, it's a little bit different, I should think. I was born and bred in Liverpool, grew up here during the 70s and 80s. You know, the city was, as many people know only too well, decimated by the advent of Thatcher, who is, you know, you can still buy shirts in the local independent bookshop that states still hate Thatcher in 2025. So that tells you a lot about how that industrial past was kind of fragmented and so on. So I left in 1988 when I went to university and then kind of spent 20 years or so, probably a bit more than that, actually, probably more like 30 years traveling around. So I lived overseas for a while. And I lived in London for over 20 years and then came back up to Liverpool in 2015 and realized that the city had reinvented itself. And it was pretty heartwarming to come back. So I moved back here 7 years ago, next month, actually. And it's been like coming home, literally. I've moved back to where I grew up as a teenager. I live really closely to the beach that I mentioned in my bio, where there's this extraordinary Anthony Gormley installation of 100 figures looking out to sea, 100 6-foot-tall cast iron figures looking out to sea over a 2-mile stretch of the beach. And for me, it's kind of this invitation to think about place is a really interesting one, because Liverpool has, as Simon's already said, its very strong sense of place, right? People are always showing off about Liverpool, whether it's kind of, you know, to claim it as a republic that's separate from the rest of the nation, to claim it as a place of special kind of humour, of pride, of an extraordinary history and legacy on all kinds of different thematics, and also a place of poetry and a place of music and creativity. So I think it says it all when you get off at Lime Street Station. There's a big glass mural that says, "Cool City, Warm Welcome." And that to me kind of sums it up. It sums up the kind of sense of place and the importance of place in the hearts of the people who grew up here. That has its flip side. It can kind of feel a little bit like arrogance sometimes, I think, but it comes with heart, is what I would say. Well,
can I just jump in for a second?
Sure.
So I grew up here in Chicago, and I've lived essentially within a mile radius of the circumference has been about a mile radius. However, as a child born in the mid-50s, Liverpool was one of the first cities I really came to know about because of the Beatles. And it was, you know, when Meet the Beatles came out, it gave my brother and I, it gave us a sense of a bigger world. And it was a game. Hey, you want to play Beatles? And we would get out instruments, pots and pans, whatever we needed to. But there was that sense of connection that the music that we knew here in Chicago was also, it was transformed in a way to your city and your sense of place.
Amazing. And you've reminded me that as you come out of the city towards the, at the top of the Dock Road, as it's known, to come towards the north of the city, there's a huge sculpture that has a quotation on it that just says Liverpool threshold to the ends of the earth. So, you know, it kind of sits neatly there.
As port cities, right? So Liverpool, Chicago, how it's grew and served transportation and migration and commerce as a port city, the ways in which a groundedness of knowing those places are also places to connect to places way beyond.
Absolutely.
The exchanging ideas, cultural notions, art, philosophy, literature.
I think that's really interesting. It's really important that one of the ways that Liverpool has reinvented itself over recent years is through its film, its contribution to filmmaking and television making. And the waterfront, the Three Graces, as they're known, the Port of Liverpool building, the Cunard building, and the Royal Liver buildings, were built at the beginning of the 20th century, I think built between 1904 and 1912, the Royal Liver building certainly, and built with an eye on that shipping exchange of culture and vision that you've just described, Dan. So they were modelled very much on the skyscrapers of New York, and there was an aspiration in the city to be like New York and to have the chic style of New York and to bring that and to be the cosmopolitan center of access to the United Kingdom, I guess, the Great British Isles, as they would have been in that period. And I find it now extraordinary that Liverpool is used as a placeholder for New York in the filmmaking context. Batman was made here with Robert Pattinson during the periods of lockdown in 2020, 2021, with Liverpool standing in for Gotham City, New York. Simon will be amused to hear that the Scousers were running by the sort of filming sites, kind of shouting, "All right, Bat Lad."
Yeah.
So bringing very kind of Scouse humour to all of that. But this idea of the places being able to stand in for one another on the back of that exchange, I find something reciprocal about that, and that kind of isn't fixed. It's something that flexes and moves according to the times that we're in, I think. It must be like that for you as well, Simon, with your Bristol connections.
Well, I feel, I mean, it's interesting. So we're all from port cities. So Bristol, Liverpool, Chicago, all port cities. You know, so we have a connection here, you know, a strong connection. And with that comes two things. One comes that great interchange and mixing of different cultures, and also comes with it in England slavery. You know, so both Bristol and Liverpool built on the slave trade, you know, and the deep kind of impact that has on the city as well, you know, that's carried with us, and people are becoming more aware of that now. I think it was buried for many years, and it's rising again. So these places are interesting, but I feel displaced. It's kind of interesting. I'm from Bristol, and I had such a strong accent when I was a Bristolian that when I went to work in Liverpool as a family therapist, the Scousers just fell apart laughing when I opened my mouth. So I'd have a family sat in front of me, and I'd say, "All right, then, how are you doing? And what's going on in your family?" And then like that. And they'd say, "What?" And I couldn't understand them either. They'd be talking about pecs and things. And I'm like, "What's a pec? Trousers, okay."
What's so a
I had to, really relearn. I was really identified with my kind of, I was a Bristol rugby player. I played for the city. I was like, played for the county, Gloucestershire. And I loved Bristol, like, you know. And then I left and went up north, and I spent most of my life up north. I was in Yorkshire, then Lancashire, Cheshire. And now I live in the west of Ireland. And I like visiting my hometown, and I'm proud of my hometown, but I don't feel it's my place anymore. But then you're forever, if you leave your hometown, you're forever displaced, because no other place is your home place. It's an interesting experience. So I'm trying to work with that at the moment.
Yeah. I think there's something really important there. There's so much important in everything that has been said so far, and it's this the evocation of history in port cities, as Dan and you have both mentioned, Simon, is incredibly important. And this outward facing, I think this is why I'm so attached to the Anthony Gormley stuff as well. There's an outward facingness. They're all looking out to sea. Some of them are in the sea, some of them buried in the sand, anchored in the sand, and so on. But there is this kind of, they're all identical, and there is this kind of expressionless gaze out to sea and an interaction with the sea and with the elements and so on that causes the 100 different statues to rust and corrode at different rates and in different ways. And for me, that connotes something about this kind of interaction with the elements and the interaction of the sea and the air and so on and so forth. But it's much more than that. I think it's an emotional piece of work. And it's something about looking outward to the sea that connotes all of that deep emotional kind of undercurrent of what it is to be human, and that anchoring or otherwise, you know, anchoring or displacement from one's roots is quite moving to consider when you are looking out to sea. And kind of for me, I know some people have that kind of sense of place and connection with mountains and hillsides and walking and stuff. For me, it's rooted very strongly in the coastal kind of context. There's a little beach, a little further up the beach from the Anthony Gormley's, is a place that's called Blitz Beach. And it's a place where they took all the rubble from the Blitzkrieg and the attacks in Liverpool during World War II. And they had to pull down all of these extraordinary buildings, these deco buildings, and so on and so forth. And they buried the rubble at the beach near where I live. And over the course of the last 40, 50 years, that rubble has now been exposed. And it's this extraordinary beach that's made of fragments of brick and building with embossed kind of lettering, and you find these chunks, and there's a kind of mysterious kind of pull for that kind of relationship between the solid man-made city finding itself exposed in the natural environment of the beach, and the encounters that can come and the evocation that comes from that, I think is really rich.
Yeah, there's a challenge in some ways about the familiarity versus novelty and the stability that a kind of object constancy can have for people to see things that are familiar and known, and it feels in some ways very safe, reassuring. And at the same time, it can also, for others, feel suffocating. It's like, I got to get out of here. What else is there? And I was thinking about the sense of groundedness and roots. It depends what kind of tree we're talking about. Because the roots of an aspen tree, while the tree may be or grow to be 50 feet high or something, the roots expand over acres deep under the soil, and there's an interconnectedness. There's a community of rootedness that goes on in a sense of place that is below the surface. And that's certainly for a psychoanalytically oriented group a good metaphor to play around with, that there's more that meets the eye about a sense of place, and it has history. It can have a sense of pride. It can have a sense of ghosts. It can have, how do you feel refreshed? How do you remake yourself? Where's the creative process in trying to make the of the here and now feel generative and growthful?
That's so right. And I think there's a lot about actually reclaiming responsibility and actually facing up to the invitation of responsibility. And Simon, you mentioned slavery there, and it's so important. You know, here in Liverpool, they've recently closed the International Museum of Slavery for a huge upgrade. So it's going to be opened in a much more, I suppose, contemporary mindset around the work to be done in the next couple of years. And it's interesting because it's based right down on the waterfront, and, you know, in the heart of the tourist centre. And it's interesting as a way, in terms of its positionality in relation to all of the other museums that one can visit and so on, how they get people in, because it's a piece of work to be done in there. It's a hugely emotive space whenever I've visited it. I'm really looking forward to how that's going to get unpacked. With regard to what Dan was just talking about there, being reframed in terms of the social obligation and the social and moral responsibility that needs to be taken around the histories that have unfolded in a place and the privilege that is accrued in certain sections of a population or community and not in others. But it's also about the work of reparation, isn't it? And trying to find a way to do that reparation and to be thinking about how actually being face to face with something that is discomforting, that is uncomfortable, an uncomfortable truth to bear, opens up space to assume that responsibility in a way that is generative. And I think in the UK, certainly, I'm not sure if this has been mirrored in the States, Dan, but in the UK over the last few years, there's been this tendency towards toppling, you know, I'm thinking about the toppling of the statue of Edward Colston in Bristol and pulling down these, you know, the stale mail markers and symbols and so on and so forth. And it's that kind of attacking mentality, the kind of destructive mentality is not enough. It's not sufficient, that there needs to be something generative that comes from it. And I think this remaking, this reframing, this reworking, rethinking of history, it demands that we kind of get in touch with uncanny, kind of unfamiliar, kind of troubling, disturbing aspects of our relationship to place, as well as the ones that we might take for granted, you know, the thing that we've seen every day as we walk along the street.
And different people, it's interesting that different people in the same place have a different experience of that place. Like I grew up in kind of a white suburb. I grew up in a council estate in Bristol initially, and then my family kind of were trying to climb the social ladder, you know, and they moved from like working class poor to sort of middle class teachers. You know, my dad was a postman, my mother was a teacher. And that put me in a white suburban working class context, you know. And I didn't know any different. But when I was 17 years old, I discovered something different. And I went to the heart of Bristol, and there's Rastas, and there's like West Indians, and there's like music, and there's anarchists, and there's like squats, and there's like this whole other world. And I just, like, my heart just opened up. It was like, wow, no, this is my place. That place wasn't my place. I left my friends back at the rugby club, and I moved. And then once I discovered the heart of Bristol, and I was hanging out in kind of the Rasta punk kind of scene. I then, you know, I was in London, and I was in the metropolitan cities and in cosmopolitan kind of areas. And I still love that. You know, I lived in the East End of London for a long time, and that felt more like my place. Whereas some other people, you know, feel very upset by their traditional white space being invaded by others. And so it's interesting, there are different concepts of place and how they're evoked by different political trends and through fear and anxieties and many things. So I'm just like thinking about how place changes depending on who you are and how you experience that space.
Yeah.
At a very micro level, you mentioned something, Simon, I think that I even see here at the school, when that people have different perceptions of what a school should be, and that when people who have send their kids here and they themselves went to school here, I have to be very clear with them that this is a different place for your child than it is for your present memory of what you think it was like when you were a kid at this school. So in a very small little domain, how to have a diversity of experiences and respect that a place can mean different things to different people, even within your own family, and to let go of some of that to make space for the next generation.
Mm. That's really important. I think it, what you're both getting at for me is the way that, and I was thinking about, you know, it's not just who you are and where you are, it's also when you are there and wherever there might be, because if I look back, and I'm sure it must be the same for both of you when you return, or when you think about returns to these homely places, that it's that we bring a different aspect of oneself, or we bring a different aspect of ourselves. So we're bringing that experience with us from these other places and other locations, and bringing new eyes to something that might seem familiar, that's informed by time away or a purposeful visit or what have you. But I think it's also very much to do with the emotional. It's to do with what's going on inside the internal space of the mind as well. For me, that's kind of encoded very much through emotional well-being and emotional experience, and really thinking about the relationship between the actual physical geographical location that we find ourselves in, the wind and the rain on our faces or whatever it might be, and the internal relationship to that space, and how those two are very difficult to mediate. That they don't match up, they don't mirror each other very well, and that gap or that dissonance between those two experiences can be really unsettling as well as really life-affirming, and it can change from one day to the next. So it's not just about what your parents remember of their school days in your school. It's also, you know, they might come again in a couple of months' time and feel very differently about it, because they're bringing a different purpose or a different set of emotional experiences to bear. So all of that relatedness, I think, is really important too.
To counter, I like what you said, in part to counter the almost romantic, even nostalgic sense of a place, there's also a different side, which is the territoriality, the sense of protection, invasion, expulsion, whose place really is it? Certainly here in the States and in the city of Chicago, the edicts of our president to expel people from the city has met with terrific resistance about whose place is it? Who has jurisdiction? Who's in charge? Everything from neighborhood associations that are protective of any new real estate developments, because they want to keep things exactly the same way they've always been, some fantasy of that. Neighborhood youth gangs controlling territory, different government agencies doing that. So a sense of place can be quite contested. I remember a book title, Contested Terrain.
Mm-hmm.
It was about labor relations in factories, and that goes for whether it's a factory and the competing class interests of the different groups that are, you know, at a place in a industrial factory or in a school or in a hospital or in a neighborhood.
Yeah, it's so important, that territorialization. You were going to say something, Simon?
Yeah, I suddenly had a free association, and it was I was on an airplane, and I was visiting Berlin, and a young man next to me, we started to talk about Berlin, and he grew up in the communist east of Berlin, and his house was about 20 meters from the wall, and he spent his whole life being on the edge of the communist bloc, being on the edge of the communist world, with the fantasy about what was behind that wall. You know, they listen to the radio and stuff, and they put stuff in. And he felt completely displaced. When the wall was knocked down, he was at the center of Berlin. So his whole world was like transformed from being kind of on the edge of an empire, literally on the edge of an empire, to being in the center of Germany, like, and the center of Europe. And he couldn't really articulate it, but he was, you know, like this troubling kind of sense of, like, you know, he didn't move, but the world moved. You know, and how the world can sort of transform around us, you know, and what that does to our emotional internal states as well.
I think, you know, I was thinking about Freud and the way Freud writes about Rome in Civilization and its discontents. And he says, you know, the temples and the palaces and the ruins, they're all there at the same time. And it's that palimpsest of history in places, and the kind of the weight of history, the burden of history, the possibilities of histories being rewritten as well, I think, are right there on the streets of all of our cities and towns. But it's about what's seen and what's put front and centre in the case of your friend in Berlin, quite literally there. But it's about how we look and what we see. And it's ways of looking in the way that is framed through all kinds of ideological process and historical and political mindsets. And yeah, there's an opportunity there, but it's not one that's very easy to unpack if you are somebody who's never moved out of place, I think. I'm curious, Simon, about your displacement and how you feel going back. Is it troubling to go back to Bristol if you feel displaced?
It is in a number of ways. I mean, one, you know, I've lost most of my family, you know, two brothers, parents, son. And Bristol was a place where we had our Christmases, where we had our, you know, our gatherings and stuff. You know, I have one brother who remains there. So I go back, and I'm a bit bereft from, you know, from my family roots that have been pulled from the place. My friends I grew up with, there's a sense of betrayal. I betrayed the city. I betrayed my roots. I actually feel it. You know, you feel this, and it's kind of a mixture of sort of envy because he could leave, but also, like, you know, betrayal because, you know, abandoned us. You know, and so there's a lot of mixed feelings. And of course, you go back, and it's not the same city. So I grew up in a rebel city in the 80s, and I just loved it. It was like, you know, the place was literally on fire. You know, in terms of music and, you know, riots and everything. You know, and it was it's a very gritty experience, a very kind of formative experience for me. And now those places are gentrified, you know, so they're you know, there's nice cafes, nice sitting, I drink a nice latte there, but it's not quite the same.
Yeah.
So, you know, the place doesn't stay the same, it changes, and yet there's echoes of the past there, you know, so it's not like a really uncomfortable place. And I love going back, and I take the kids and we have a nice time with my brother and stuff, you know. And you know, my wife's Polish, and she really enjoys Bristol, and we have a good time. But there's I think Freud's paper on the uncanny would sum it up. You know, I can't quite describe that a discomfort. I wouldn't go so far as discomfort.
Yeah.
But there's something uncanny, like that. There's ghosts of the past are there, but not there. That kind of experience, you know.
Yeah. It's the familiar and painful all at once.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that uncanny piece is really important. It's that. You know, I'm getting old, so whenever now when I go back to London, which I do quite a lot for work, I kind of run around kind of going, what? You know, the transformation of London is happening so quickly. And even though I lived there for more than 20 years, I go to places that do not look like they did even 5 years ago, and I feel completely lost.
Yes.
And it's as though any command or expertise of around the geography of the place has been completely wiped out without my knowledge. And it's a sense of overwhelm that I find quite distancing. And there's a kind of uncanniness sometimes. You can be walking down the street. You know, I don't know if either of you've visited the newly restored King's Cross and Colesdrop Yard at the back of King's Cross Station, which used to be, you know, during the 90s and 2000s, one of the most kind of lawless kind of parts of London.
Dodgy place.
Really dodgy. And it was where you went out raving, you know, on a dodgy Saturday night at Bagley's nightclub, you know, which was not a nightclub. It was a series of very, very, very run-down cellar spaces. And I found myself walking through there a few weeks ago, and I was thinking about the placemaking that's gone on, and they've done a good job. It's a lovely place, you know. It's a pleasant, contemporary, quite chic, very white space, I think, and it's aimed at a certain kind of demographic. But I cut through one of the shops, and as I cut through the shop to get to the other side of the buildings, there was a plaque up there saying, "You are now where you are now standing was the entrance to Bagley's Club in the '90s," and I just had this kind of this uncanny feeling that you're talking about something where I just remember being there, being quite scared, but also very, very excited in the '90s, you know, queuing to get in and thinking this couldn't be further removed from that experience. It's very kind of anodyne, high-end, you know, commercial, fashion-forward kind of space, selling ridiculously overpriced objects to very wealthy people at such a remove from that very kind of gritty history, and yet being connoted for those people, you know. So my uncanniness was also about, if I am supposed to remember that, which I do, am I now also supposed to be the demographic for this shop, which I am not? And so there is an uncanniness in terms of the who I am in relation to the weight of history and expectation on place. Because I think that the histories that we tell in places change our relationship to them.
Yeah.
And that comes with a weight of emotional experience, I think.
Yeah. There's
a couple of thoughts. You mentioned the plaque outside. One of the things that was quite active for a while, at least here in Chicago, was either plaques on walls or a verbal statement at the beginning of particular cultural events here in Chicago, a land acknowledgement that prior to the arrival of European white settlers, this land was, the Potawatomi people were here. And then that then made me think about this sense of place in the mind and where people feel at home or they don't feel at home, and how two people who live in within the same structure can have a different sense of, now put that couch over there rather than that chair over there. So it can become so micro within people's lives, and that so much about what clinicians have talked to me about is that in dream life, how dreams are often struggling with the sense of the location of emotions and how to, you know, the struggle to get everything in the right place, and that one person's mode of change is a gain, and for somebody else, it's a loss. It's a disconnect. And so there's always a kind of renovation happening on the old house, the fantasy that you can kind of scrape it to the ground and start fresh is more the fantasy than the reality of there's constant renovation that's happening within our sense of self as a place.
I mean, it's interesting. In my coaching work, as Carol knows, I do an exercise and you know, Dan, called locating ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, so, and it's not to try and give people a fixed sense of identity or fix them in a place, but it's to just ask a question, you know, because so many people do feel dislocated. And that's why I came up with a locating ourselves exercise, because in my coaching work, you know, you have intimate conversations with people about their lives, and they express in many different ways that they feel dislocated, you know. And I think it's like a human experience of modernity, being dislocated from the earth, from the bioregions we grew up in. I think there's there's this sense of displacement generally through modernity. And I've just come back from China, and I have no idea how the Chinese are coping with such a rush to modernity. I mean, it's like I've never been seen before in humankind that they've taken 60 million out of poverty and built these tower blocks everywhere. And like, it's a phenomenal achievement. And at the same time, it's a very displacing achievement, you know.
Yeah.
And we ran an experiential event with people there, a group relations event, and it was, you could see people really struggling with this, talking about when they used to live in a planned economy and now the individualism, what that means, and all that stuff. And you know, the power of it is phenomenal. And a lot of people, I think, are feeling displaced. I think as coaches and consultants and in schools, I think giving a sense of place is hugely important. Hugely important, and finding some sense of place, whatever that means. And I don't think anyone takes it, or there's no fixed idea of that, but to help people explore that and get some sense of it, I think is really important work.
Yeah.
And it's the relationship of different places.
Mm-hmm.
So at the turn of the 19th into 20th century, the idea of what a progressive school could be was to provide children with an experience that was different from the home. The home was tended to be a more structured environment, and the freedoms that teachers and students would have to explore something and to go in depth was what schools were doing. Now, today, some of the more contemporary tensions are, well, maybe the home isn't as structured or as supervised. So there's a movement within schools, at least in the States, to ban cell phones for students, because there has to be a firmer boundary between one place, the home, and the school. And what kind of community are these two places trying to co-create, sometimes in tension and sometimes in coordination, of what that learning developmental experience is going to be like? And where do you put where in this place do you acknowledge the voices of the students, the young people themselves, in trying to name what their location is as all these adults are talking about them?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that dislocation piece is it's just really, really live at the moment, isn't it? Globally, culturally,
yes.
You know, the struggle for borders, the struggle for the right to kind of move and take refuge in places of safety, and who has a right to a refugee status, and who has, you know, if we're thinking about the expulsions that you mentioned earlier around the ICE kind of policy at the moment in the States and so on. There's this kind of idea of it's almost a kind of a struggle for the right to colonize that space and to recolonize spaces in the name of an empowered authority and to evacuate any challenge to that. And it's a really, really fearful time that we're living in, isn't it? And the defensiveness of such attacks and the refusals of, you know, asylum seekers across Europe and so on and so forth. There's something about equity, power, and place, and the perceptions of intrusion, the perceptions of the value of evacuation, the value of expulsion. This all speaks for me to the idea of mental space, and, you know, the way that the struggle is really for a sense of self and a sense of meaningful community. And I was thinking about the different psychoanalytic kind of takes on this. And thinking that, you know, we feel very far removed from the nice, playful Winnicottian kind of idea of space and place at the moment. It's the playfulness is being kind of eradicated by these hard, hard boundaries and this extraordinarily authoritarian kind of bit of policing that's going. But the consequence of that is that people then take refuge in this fantasy space and the Kleinian kind of model. You know, that the internal world is what we imagine it to be, and we relate more to our internal objects than to what we're actually faced with in the world. And for me, what's getting eroded is that Bionian idea of the space to think, you know, the pace of change that you've just gestured towards in China, the kind of flight to modernity and so on. It just removes this kind of capacity to be able to perceive, reflect, explore the emotional kind of things that come up in us and to find ways of having them contained, finding the container contained piece, if you like, to be able to enable us to think. And so it's a thoughtlessness that's at work. And it's, I think it's really interesting, therefore, Dan, that schools become this site of struggle. So in the UK, what we're hearing a lot is that children are being sent to primary school without, you know, training to manage their toilet habits or
We're seeing this here.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
And it's this blurring of boundary between, you know, what we're seeing is it gets cold and all of a sudden schools are collecting old coats because such is the level of child poverty that the kids are coming to school without coats. And so this blurring of boundary of parental responsibility and that where safety lies, you know, Winnicott, home is where we start from, but actually it's increasingly school in terms of that sense of
psychological,
emotional safety, knowing how to be in the world, feeling contained and so on. At least that's how it seems from the outside.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate what you said. I've seen over the arc of my career in schools that schools as the place is being asked to do more and more of the parental functions that at a different time was much more within the domain of the home and what teachers have to be trained to do and think about, and the challenge becomes greater.
And it's
particularly
not
with the authoritarianism you're talking about, how to protect students from the outside world.
And it's not just a loss of, it's not like a loss of a nuclear family home. It's that community home, isn't it? The community brought up the child. So there was, if a child was without a coat, the community would sort it. You know, they'd find a coat for the child. And there's that gap. Of course, the other, you know, sense of displacement is, you know, the virtual place. You know, for many young people growing up in the digital age, it's a virtual place, which is their closest location, their point of reference for community or friendship or engagement. So the mobile phone or a digital kind of object becomes your place rather than the physical place. And that's, you know, that's another kind of displacement in a way, because it's a virtual place will always be a virtual place, however nice or cozy or enchanting it might be.
And it's an active 24-hour space.
Yeah.
And it's also increasingly, I think, a place that there isn't any co-location in the digital space, or increasingly less co-location. So one of the things that I've noticed watching young people around me is they don't speak on the phone, or they don't even have live text conversation. They will voice note each other. So they're not actually co-located. It's a very kind of, it's like they're constantly at a terminus, you know. That's the end of my contribution. And now there's another chunk of this journey and so on. And that's this, again, I'm kind of interested in time. I read a piece the other day in the paper which talked about the so-called Gen Z stare, right? That the young people now getting jobs in cafe bars or coffee shops or whatever do not say hello. So you come in and they will kind of give you the stare. And there is no kind of greeting or welcome. And the piece was a kind of opinion piece, and it was kind of saying, you know, this is really discombobulating to someone of my generation, for instance, where you're used to kind of going, especially if you're from Liverpool, you can't not have a conversation if you go into a coffee shop. It's, you know, it's you expect to, especially in the context of America, have a nice day and, you know, good evening, good afternoon, whatever it might be, that welcoming kind of hospitality piece eroded. The exploration was about, is this because they can only communicate in voice notes and they're not used to actually having an interlocution, to actually having live in the same place and moment? And I started really thinking about what that means in terms of the digital place, because it's almost as though you've got a series of tiny little stepping stones that people have towards connection. And what does that do? What does that do to the sense of internal place? So I'm kind of really curious about it. I don't have much data to work with on it, but it's just something I'm noticing around me at the moment.
I like that example of what is a greeting. You might like a teacher here with his 10 and 11 year old students. It's around fifth grade for us. Has been each year teaching his students, how do you shake hands? How do you look somebody in the eye? What's a firm grip? How do you actually do this thing where people meet in a place?
I went to a study in Berkeley, California, a while back. I don't know how long ago, but it was a while back. I'd say 18 years or something. And it was so interesting because it was the first time I walked into a cafe and it was filled with people looking into laptops. And I was taking photographs of people working on laptops in cafes, like, you know, what's happened to conversation? What's happened to conviviality? What's happened? You know, everyone's kind of reduced into their. And on the same trip, I took a road trip, and I had this amazing road trip through kind of the desert and the mountains. And I ended up in the Big Sur, and I went down the Pacific coast, and I saw this sign, and it said Hermitage. I followed the mountain road up to the Hermitage, and I camped outside. And one of the monks was going for his morning run, actually, and he saw me, and he said, come in and stay with us now. Like, you're welcome. This is a place of hospitality, you know. So I came and I stayed with them. And whilst I was there, there was a young man in his 30s, and he was taking his vows. And the vows were celibacy and stability and obedience. And I'm in the most beautiful place I've probably ever been, I think. This is on top of the mountain in the Big Sur, overlooking the Pacific Ocean in this monastery. And it was like, I went back again. It moved me immensely, like just the beauty. But to listen to a young man take a vow of stability, I was like, wow. So he's deciding to stay here for the rest of his life in this monastery.
Mm.
And I thought, how countercultural that is. How radical that is. What a radical decision that is, you know. And what does that mean for place? And it just kind of threw it back at me, and I said, what am I doing? You know, I'm traveling all over the world, I'm doing all this exciting stuff, you know, but, you know, where is my place? Like, he knew his place, and he's gonna die in that place.
Yeah. And your story about the cafe in California reminds me of Christopher Bolas in his rather wonderful book Meaning and Melancholia. Talks about being in the Rose Cafe in Venice, in Los Angeles, for a Sunday brunch. And, you know, it's a swanky cafe. It's full of, like, people who know their stuff about all of the critical thinking, psychoanalysis, all of this kind of stuff. And they're meeting for a kind of middle-aged people's brunch. And he talks about how couples will turn up and one of them will start a story of why they're late because, you know, the 101, blah, 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 there was a crash and yada, yada, yada. And then there will be a ping on his or her phone. And so the immediate distraction is to the phone. And the partner will then pick up and fill in. And then their phone pings and somebody else will then pick up. And it's like this constant relay of relatedness and responsibility, and that the story, the idea of a story, kind of dissipates as a result. And he kind of observes all of this in that lovely way that Bolas has, and kind of comes up with some extraordinary mind-blowing stuff. But I was thinking about how, with the digital space and digital place in mind, we're in two places all the time.
Yeah.
And you can be totally preoccupied. You know, we're in a virtual place here, Simon's studio. The welcome was into Simon's studio, but it's a virtual studio. And it's this exchange that we have that's kind of mediated and impacted by bandwidth dropping and, you know, has my joke landed correctly, or is that just a flicker in the bandwidth, or whatever it might be? But at the same time, we're completely at odds with one another in terms of the places that we find ourselves in, the reality of what's going on in the background, or whether, you know, we're feeling cold or hot or whatever. We've got dual levels of experience that we don't think about very often. And we don't, I think it's really interesting, you know. I was doing some training with an organization a few weeks ago on mindfulness, and an example was given about the difficulty of multitasking. And, you know, the idea that was given was Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow. That's 11 words. How quickly can you say it? Now count to 11, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Now do Mary 1, had 2, A, 3, and you have to slow right down. The idea you can't think these two things simultaneously. And I think that's the same about these places that we're in. It's kind of, where is the preoccupation and how does that impact, on the one hand, relatedness and the problems that we've talked about in terms of an erosion of community, but also how, where we feel our self is. Or do we have multiple selves?
The example you gave, Carl, was really interesting. It made me think that, at least in the pre-digital age when I was growing up, that the tension was to be in one place or two places. Either you were engaged in what you were doing, or you were having a daydream. But the pinging, as you described, could be a group chat where now it's like you're talking to me and you're talking to Simon and your phone's buzzing and it's like six different group chats going on. So now it's many more variables of attention, distraction, complication, and how do you feel centered and focused where the people you're with feel like you actually are respecting them with that sense of attention.
So I'm supposed to be in two places now. I'm supposed to be picking up the children and I'm on a virtual. I'm going to bring
this time flew then. By. What a joy to talk to both of you. Thank you
Absolutely.
For the invitation.
Yeah. Absolute pleasure.
We end the podcast with a couple of questions. One is about living a good life, what it means to live a good life, and the other is what it means to create a good society. And I wonder if we could just think any free associations around the idea of how place helps us think about what it means to live a good life and from your just personal experience, or any associations and what place means to create a good society. And any thoughts at all? Just throw out anything.
You must have been in the room with me yesterday. We were talking about education and AI and what all this is going to do for teachers, students, the whole thing. And I said, there are many other AIs, and one is the ancient intelligence of the philosophers. And to have students spend time, not in computer science classes, because AI will create the computer science coding, but what the philosophers had to say of what's a good life, what's a good society, how do you make ethical decisions, that's still something that can ground us and give us a sense of purpose and focus and meaning in the place of this school.
Very good. Thank you, Dan.
Lovely. I think if I playfully kind of throw in what an average Scouser would say, it would be to create a good life and to create a good society, it's don't be a Tory.
Yeah.
But more importantly, and I think more in tune with the conversation that we've been having, is I think for me it's about trying to stay present with where you are and where you find yourself.
Lovely. Lovely conversation, very enjoyable. I hope the audience will enjoy it too. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Cara.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you both.